a lot of what I found is that pattern recognition plays a huge component in how I identify good opportunities and how I try to come up with solutions to problems. So a lot of times I say, oh, this company or this opportunity looks a lot like these companies that I've worked with before, and they found success by doing this. Or, you know, this is a problem that I've seen before, another company successfully navigated it in this way.
You're listening to the Founder Podcast Series, your source for inspiration and insights from successful entrepreneurs from the Yale community. I'm Nathaniel Johnson, and I'm here with my co-host, Elena Derevyanko, to inspire and encourage an entrepreneurial mindset among those who possess an inclination towards innovation without being dissuaded by inherent risks. Today, we have with us Chris Brady Jr., an experienced entrepreneur with a diverse range of accomplishments. Chris has a background in venture capital, co-founding and managing a mobile AR development company, and is currently managing assets for a fund. He's also started other business ventures focusing on sustainability and innovation. We are privileged to have Chris join us on our pod to share his insights and expertise in becoming a successful entrepreneur. Yeah, so we can get started. We've seen a lot of things you've created, but we're just going to get a brief overview of maybe this your favorite accomplishments as a recent.
Sure. Well, I think the first notable instance of me kind of taking a different path was when I graduated from university in 2005. I was a history major, no technical background. I'd done some internships over summers at finance institutions, but in no way, shape, or form did I think that, you know, I was ready to go out into the financial services world of any in any capacity. And I ended up going and working at an Army base as an intern, working at a nonprofit. Really just inserting myself in between private sector technology companies and DoD contractors, essentially facilitating tech transfer and conversations. And out of that, I identified an opportunity to invest in technology that had this commercial defense government, what we call dual use applicability. And we ended up raising an $80 million fund to support those companies. And so I was 9 months out of college and found myself as part of the founding team of a venture fund. And I had, you know, the people I was with, they had venture experience. I was the low guy in the totem pole, but I really had to learn everything from scratch. And it was very much a sink or swim environment, which I think I ended up excelling at. But that was a crazy, a very lucky opportunity. I think it was a combination of time and opportunity. But I saw something that I thought was interesting, and I pursued it. And it culminated in really the beginning of the rest of my career.
Yeah. You talked about the commercializing the defense technology, right? $80 million, you know, that's a lot of money. How did you kind of, you said this, you kind of knew the game as well. So how did you kind of, I guess, adapt like this, whatever marketing transition to kind of be ahead of everyone else, right? You said it was partial luck, but there must have been some sort of skill to it.
Sure. I mean, the luck and the timing component, it was a period where, you know, we were at war in the Middle East. There were a lot of challenges that the government was the Defense Department was trying to address through technology, and they started to look through to the private sector to help them solve some of those challenges. Historically, it's been very kind of walled off, a walled garden, if you will. And they like to kind of develop everything themselves or in partnership with the large systems integrators. So they changed their mindset and they started looking to the private sector. So that was lucky, right? That was, if it was a couple of years before, I wouldn't have had this opportunity. What I realized in facilitating these tech transfer opportunities was that, A, there was a lot more overlap between the technologies that the commercial sector and the defense sector were working on. The second thing that I identified was that they talk about it in totally different manners. They actually have different vocabularies. They might be talking about the same technology, but it's almost like they're speaking two different languages. And so my role was essentially bridging that gap, knowing how to talk to both communities and then facilitating that discussion and translating for them in essence. And then lastly, the other thing that we identified is that because of this complexity in the defense side of things, because they historically had been relatively siloed and looking from their own community, that there was not very much commercial investment into defense technology. There were just a handful of institutional investors that would back defense technology because you get lower multiples on exit. You really had to understand the market to be able to thrive in it. And so as a commercial VC, you're not going to add much value on the defense side of things. So we thought that there is a large market with very few dollars going after it. And so that to us said that there was an opportunity.
Amazing. We really like how you are talking about the importance of timing, but also importance of identifying some gaps and missing things in the niche that you kind of explore and come up with solutions how to fill those in. Could you please talk about how venture capital itself and like experience in that helped you in entrepreneurship and helped you like both sides?
Sure. I'll flip that question a little bit on its head. And let me give you an example of another example of a company that I started that came at it from a different perspective. So in 2009, I started a company that was developing mobile augmented reality technology. So core computer vision algorithms that would run on a mobile phone. Very early. Nobody knew what AR was back then, but it came out of our work in the defense space. And we said, this is a transformative technology, and we think that this team is the best team, and they've got a unique niche, we've got some customers, and we can take this to market. But we didn't know really what the gap we were trying to fill was. It was a technology looking for a home. And a lot of time I find that is a much more difficult problem. It's like virtual reality is a technology that they're spending a lot of money on, right? Facebook is creating the metaverse, but there's no kind of killer application that says, oh, this technology is a perfect solution to this problem. And so I think that from that experience, I became a better investor later on because I realized that technology on itself isn't necessarily going to be, just because it's the best technology doesn't mean it's going to win. There needs to be an opportunity. Timing is a big part of that. But you really need to marry both the opportunity with the technology to come up with a solution that people are actually going to use and want in practicality.
Yeah. So, the mobile augmented reality, you kind of touched upon that the timing was a bit too early, right? There wasn't really a need for that technology. But in a sense, let's say the social media, you know, proliferation lasts like 10, 15 years. You have, you know, Instagram, Facebook, they're all kind of built upon, I guess, improving an experience, right? Rather than there being a perfect intersection of timing. Technology was like adaptive in order to make that grow. Everyone had iPhones at the same time. Instagram comes up with a way to instantly capture pictures and filter them. But why would you say, in a sense, that, let's say for like the mobile augmented reality, for example, that the timing was not, or sorry, the problem was not there, right? Because if the timing was, it's more of an enhancement of experience.
Yeah, well, in 2009, when we started the company, I think the first iPhone with a camera had just been released, to give you some perspective of how early this was in the hardware cycle, which, you know, if you don't have a camera on your phone, it cannot do augmented reality, right? And the API was not open yet. So we were actually hacking iPhones to be able to run our code on the device. But we had a pretty good sense that it was going to be open. We didn't know if it was going to be in 6 months or a year or 2 years, but we were confident that eventually the camera is something that they would want to let people develop on top of. So it was early because the technology, the hardware, was just kind of getting good enough to actually do basic functionality. But from a user community standpoint, I think it was still too new. I mean, think about it. Like, the selfie was just kind of becoming a thing, right? The selfie was a new user behavior enabled by technology development, right? That all of a sudden you've got a camera that faces you now, and now you can do a selfie, right? So I think that the user behavior, when we talked about augmented reality and the fact that you could point your phone at an object and it could recognize it and create this digital experience, people were like, I don't understand how that can work. And they couldn't get over the just how does this work, and how, so they could never get to the how can I now use this in my daily life or in for some application. You know, I think it was like Pokemon Go was like the first mass augmented reality experience, even though, you know, if you want to be technical about it, it wasn't a real augmented reality experience. It was overlaying digital graphics on the real world. There wasn't any true interaction between the two, but so it took time for people to understand, like, oh, you can have this mixed reality environment. So from that standpoint, it was just early. And today, I mean, you have TikTok filters, right? That's augmented reality right there. That's like a pure play augmented reality. And it's fun, right? People use them all the time. And so it just took kind of a product. It took a product that leverages the technology for a good experience to become widespread.
Amazing. And so to follow up on that, how has your approach and business itself kind of shift over time and adapt itself to all the fast paced and really growing innovations in technology and social media and everything?
Great question. So I started to evolve naturally from a very narrow focus on defense technology that had commercial applications to a broader set of sectors that I was interested in. And I would consider myself now very much a generalist, not even just a general technology investor, but I like CPG companies. I like manufacturing companies, you know, as well as AI and other sorts of really tech-centric sectors. And initially, that was driven by companies that I had invested in starting to get into new markets. I'd say one of the trends that I noticed was almost every one of our companies that started in defense branched out into much larger commercial opportunities. And so that brought me into the worlds of a few examples: commercial geospatial analysis, remote video conferencing, both the hardware and the software platforms, liquid cooling for data centers, even composite railroad tie manufacturing. So this defense sectoral focus really branched out and brought me into all these different areas. So that widened my canvas in terms of understanding how these different markets operated, different types of companies. And it really made me want to keep expanding what I was focused on. And so I've actually gone on to look, not just expanded in terms of what types of companies I look at investing in, but also the way I deploy my capital. So I started getting very interested in working capital because I saw those challenges. This is even pre-pandemic. I saw a lot of my companies that were growing and were finding success and had that market product market fit. They're actually were having a bigger challenge with their cash flow as they got more traction. So revenue was skyrocketing, but they had less and less cash on hand. And these working capital challenges I first saw in a lot of the manufacturing companies. And so I said, well, I want to understand that. And I think in venture capital, like PE, they have to use a lot of debt in their deals. So they understand both sides of the credit and equity side. But in venture, we're just really no equity. And so I wanted to understand the debt component. I really saw working capital as something that was important to companies, whether they're just starting out to when they're growing rapidly, even to when they're mature. So I started providing working capital finance to companies. And then now I'm getting more into the private equity side of things. And so I don't look at my evolution in terms of just the types of companies I look at, but also the types of capital that I'm deploying in different strategies, because you might find a great company, but venture funding, it's already too late. Venture funding doesn't make sense, but you can still play either in private equity or by lending them capital to grow. There's a lot of different ways to interact with companies as a financier. And so I'm trying to expand my repertoire of tools that I can employ to help companies grow.
Amazing. And what would you say are the most transferable tools, skills that you mentioned?
I'd say just the fundamentals of starting and operating a business. Let me back up. The fundamentals of operating a business, I think, are really important. And it doesn't really matter if you're a very young company or a very mature company. There's certain things that, like, good governance is applicable across the spectrum of companies. So I think that actually starting a company is a great experience, because there are so many little things that you never think about that go into first just creating the entity and bringing people on board and setting up the processes and the organization. I think that makes you much more aware of the what it takes to actually run a company, and actually you get a more minute view of what it takes, right? And then it's just, once you see some companies that just run really well, you can never unsee that. So they become like the gold standard. And so you can start to transfer the knowledge of how a really good company operates in a certain space to other companies. There's always going to be differences between, like a semiconductor company has a very different set of challenges than a SaaS company. But at the end of the day, there's some really good management principles that can be applied universally. I think transparency and how you keep your employees informed is one thing I've learned, that the best managers over communicate. So I just say the day-to-day operations, that's where I think I've learned the most and can add the most value, regardless of what stage or what even sector the company is in. And then I think actually getting involved in the startup process, that's the best way to learn, you know, fundamentally, this is the first building block of what it takes to create a company, and everything else is kind of expanding on top of that. Awesome. Waldo, please. Sorry, my dog's snoring beside me. No problem.
Yeah, so you talked about kind of, growing businesses and some of your investments in certain businesses, right? Your niche started from commercialized defense, right? And you're kind of branching out, I guess, to ride these like technological waves of breakthroughs, right? Because if these companies are proliferating, you kind of want to help grow that. What specific metrics, and you mentioned some of like employee engagement and such, do you kind of gauge to gauge a potential of a company, kind of like a cap in the sense of how far they could grow?
Well, market size is obviously critical. If your market's only $100 million, you're never gonna, even if you capture 100% of the market, you're not gonna grow beyond that. And so I really, every opportunity has to be a $1 billion plus opportunity, for me to get excited at an early stage, because you need to, it needs to be a big enough opportunity for you to, gain a little bit of market share and still be a success. And you want every company that you invest in at an early stage to have 100x return potential, right? And so by definition, you have to start with a big pie that you're addressing. Now, the difference between total addressable market and serviceable addressable market, that could be $1 billion TAM and $50 million SAM. So it's not like just how big is the total universe of opportunities here, but it's like if you realistically address this market with this technology, how big could it be? But I guess the net is it needs to be a big market that you're going after. Competition is critical as well to that calculus, right? If there's one company or two companies that really dominate the landscape, you have to be a revolutionary technology or business model or something, to unseat the incumbents, right? So you have to have something really unique, versus if it's a small market, but it's getting big, right? I think that was what we thought the augmented reality opportunity was, like 2009, small, but we were talking to DARPA and to Google X and to all these companies, and they were like, no, this is going to be huge, and we can see hundreds of millions of dollars going into this space in 2, 3 years. So we said, okay, this is small now, but it's growing rapidly, and it's kind of a blue ocean opportunity. There's nobody dominating it. We've got a great team here, so we think we've got a good chance at getting a large portion of maybe a mid-sized market. So size and competition, competitive landscape are go hand in hand to understand what sort of just how big the business can get. But then immediately after that is the team. And the reason I don't put team first is because you could have an absolute rock star team with the best technology ever, but if it's a really tiny market, it's only going to grow so large. But if you have a great technology in a big market and you don't have a great team, you're going to fail 100% of the time. And so it's kind of like, table stakes are having a big opportunity, and then you need to have just a rock solid team to go address it. And that doesn't necessarily mean the smartest humans on earth. I've seen really smart people who have been bad entrepreneurs. And so you're looking for for a combination of somebody who is innovative and entrepreneurial, but has experience taking product to market and having success in the past. That for me is a critical component to backing somebody. And that being said, I've backed quite a few young Yalies even, who have never started a company before, and this is their first venture, but they showed some of that really critical intuitiveness for understanding how to take their product to market, and were willing to work with their investors. And so in those situations, I'm investing earlier and I'm working very actively with the founding team to get kind of that found that the beginning of the company settled, right? It's not necessarily product market fit, but all the hard stuff of just like getting a team, getting the company set up, starting to creating the product roadmap and creating that strategy to go to market. I really enjoy doing that with teams, and then helping them raise the, you know, the seed round and handing it off to, you know, more seasoned professionals that'll sit on the board and do this more institutionally. So when it's earlier, and I find entrepreneurs that might still be a little green, but they're really willing to work with me on kind of a weekly basis, as almost an advisor capacity, then I'm happy to step in and forego that kind of experience component because I'm bringing that to the table.
Awesome. So you've talked about all the different categories, from how big the market is to the team, to the idea, to the execution, and how you also look at that as an investor. But as a founder, what do you think is one single most important thing, or like something that is make or break?
It's passion and it's drive, and they kind of go hand in hand. If somebody is, I'll give you an example. There's a company that was creating a haptic wearable that allows you to control things, using a wrist-worn device. And the founder was absolutely incredibly smart, MIT graduate. So like, okay, he checks those boxes, but the reason he was doing this and not at a hedge fund making millions of dollars or something is because his mother had a disease, where she was losing, motor functions, and he wanted to create a product that would benefit her and improve her life. And so this was an incredibly personal story that, it showed how much he cared so much. It really showed in his drive and commitment to the opportunity. And I knew that that he would never, ever leave anything on the field. He was going to give 100% and more to do everything he could to make this a success because he was mission driven. And so when there's teams that believe that they're part of something bigger, I think that's the best signal for me that it's a team I want to be involved with.
Yeah. Like from a team aspect, I think like not only is it chemistry itself, but like if there's that like, you know, drive, right? You can kind of like query that to like a bigger cause and works. So I mean, nowadays, I guess like even the brightest minds, we kind of see this in our own school at Yale, right? Are kind of dissuaded from pursuing the light bulb moments, right? Even if they have an idea or innovation, it's somewhat hard for them to pursue that because their intelligence kind of serves as a hindrance rather than a strength.
So, and building off of that, what parting advice would you give to like those students who have the potential to innovate but are discouraged by just what Nathaniel mentioned, by taking the risk?
The first thing I'll say, and this might be a little controversial, but it's not for everyone. Not everybody who has an idea should be an entrepreneur. Even if it's a great idea, you have to have a high tolerance for risk and failure. In many cases, you're going to have to go through a lot of hardships. It's difficult to raise capital when you haven't done it before and you don't have a track record. So as somebody coming out of college, you're an unknown entity to some degree. And so it will be hard. You'll get a lot of no's. You might have to be super scrappy for longer than you're comfortable with. And it might not work and you might lose a couple of years, but at no point will you ever not be learning and learning new skills that can be transferable across the rest of your life. So I think that it's scary and it's tough and it's not for everyone, but it is incredibly rewarding. I think if it's a path that you do want to go down or that you're thinking about, I would say that the best thing to do is just start getting involved. A lot of people ask me, you know, how do I position myself to become a VC? Well, it's tough. There's not many, not many positions. And historically, they came mostly from people who have been in an industry for 10 years. So, you know, you've been in life sciences for 10 years and then you go and get hired by a life science VC. It's changed quite a bit. And I think that VCs are looking for investors that are entrepreneurs themselves. And so I think both as up and coming VCs, but also as, you know, when they invest in somebody, they want to see a track record of entrepreneurship. So, you know, even if you're, you know, have a couple more years of school, what are you doing on your breaks? What are you doing over the summer? You should go intern at technology companies, at startups. You know, if you can volunteer your time, go find a startup that you find that's really interesting and just go do it for a little bit, right? Startups are looking for people to all the time to help them out. If you come in and say, I'll do it for free for a little bit, even better for them. And you'll probably end up getting more and more responsibility and find yourself occupying a couple different roles. Cause if it's a small team, everybody has to do a bit of everything. And so I would say just demonstrate your entrepreneurial spirit and start getting out there, before you actually take the plunge and decide to go into it. Right. So first of all, see if you like it, go do it for a little bit, whether it's interning at a VC fund or a startup or, you know, becoming part of Yes. I mean, that alone, you know, that gives you a leg up on somebody who I came out of Yale, with less venture experience than you guys. So, you're already a little bit ahead of where I was when I graduated. But I'd say just go out there and just start doing it. See if you enjoy it. And just be confident that, or I would say when you make the decision to go into it, go all in. Like don't keep one foot in, you know, sure, you can work on your idea while working full time at another company, but once you decide this is the thing that I'm going to do, go all in. Because I don't think anybody really has found success doing it half-assed.
Yeah, thank you for that. I think the notion of just going all in is sometimes, I guess, it's scary to a lot of people, right? But that's often how you make it.
It's a lot less scary when you're in your 20s and you don't have a family or much overhead and much less to lose. And, you know, you can always say that, you know, I spent these 2 years of my resume, you know, I spent trying to build a company and here's what I learned while doing that. And while it wasn't ultimately successful from a financial standpoint, it was successful from an experience and you know, whatever ways you might find success and failure. So do it when you're young, because failure hurts less at that stage in your life. But yeah, I mean, it's exciting. I've never been bored doing what I'm doing. I love it every day. And you meet really interesting, motivated people. You're constantly learning. And for me, and I think a lot of Yaleys, I think that's, what more could you ask for?
Awesome. And kind of following up on that, what do you think is the biggest mistake that young entrepreneurs that have a lot of potential, great ideas, what is the biggest mistake that they make?
I think there's a subset of really, really smart people with young entrepreneurs with good ideas, that don't know what they don't know. And they don't lean on their advisors and investors and mentors and older, more experienced network. So I would say that try to learn as much as possible or run things by people that you admire and are experienced and have gone through problems that you're trying to work on before, because I don't know a lot. I don't know everything, right? But I know a lot of ways not to do things from my firsthand failures. So at the very least, I can help young entrepreneurs avoid some of the mistakes that I've made in my past. And a lot of what I found is that pattern recognition plays a huge component in how I identify good opportunities and how I try to come up with solutions to problems. So a lot of times I say, oh, this company or this opportunity looks a lot like these companies that I've worked with before, and they found success by doing this. Or, you know, this is a problem that I've seen before. Another company successfully navigated it in this way. And so, you know, they're not always going to be apples to apples, but I think that you can find wisdom in, like, I was a history major, right? So history doesn't necessarily exactly repeat itself, right? But it sure does rhyme. And I think that's true of startups, that you can find wisdom in how companies have found success in the past. And so a lot of the reading that I do is on case studies and, you know, what really successful entrepreneurs, you know, what have they done? What made them so successful? What habits or ways of looking at the world, made them uniquely successful? And so, I would say when you're young and just starting out, you might have an idea of the right way to proceed, but it's never bad to go get some advice from somebody who's been around the block a couple times.
It's a really great response. I think it's very important for other students to see that, like, their majors, kind of like history, international relations, can be so transferable to different spheres like venture capital, investing, entrepreneurship, and it might not necessarily be very obvious. So it's amazing that you brought that up as kind of an inspiration for others.
Sure. I mean, I'll just make one point on that. I mean, you know, a lot of times people are surprised that I was a history major, and got into the venture space, and did so without any sort of technical training. But when you boil it down, writing a history paper, like writing my senior thesis, you know, I pulled on previous lectures and classes that I had taken, kind of come up with an area I wanted to look at. So past experience informed where I wanted to focus. I, you know, did some research, came up with a thesis, and then wrote a paper that supported that thesis using resources and things like that. Well, it's not that dissimilar to coming up with an investment thesis for a company. So a lot of what I did was use skills that I learned as a history major and applied it to investing. You know, I think this sector is interesting because I've seen other companies in it and they've been successful or whatever. There's some signal there that I like. I think this company is intriguing because of X, Y, and Z. Now I'm going to go through the process of writing an investment document, and I'm going to try and support that thesis through my research and present it to an investment committee that's going to essentially grade me on it. If I pass, we do the deal, right? So, and that wasn't obvious to me for a few years. And then I was like, oh, you know what? These are actually skills that I learned in university in history that transferred. Great, you know, fantastic. And then I, you know, learned how to be an Excel wizard and learned how to get, I don't know, understand technology at a 10,000 foot level, and then go find people who are smarter than me to understand it down to 1,000 feet. So you're never going to come out of university with all the skills that you need to succeed in any profession. So it's really about leveraging the skill sets that you do graduate with, applying them to whatever vertical that you're going into, and then figuring out ways to start to add to your skill set, or at least add to your network so that you can rely on other people with these skill sets, so that you can become, you know, trying to become like a full stack investor, right? So you can do everything from start a company to invest in one, to being an advisor, an operator, whatever. That's for me, I'm always just trying to learn new things. Like I mentioned, new ways to deploy capital, new sectors to go after, new stages in the capital stack to focus on. For me, it's constantly evolving and adding tools to my tool belt.
Yeah. And one thing I want to add is it's so interesting how all the entrepreneurs today are so diverse, right? In a sense that their own skills they brought up, you know, in school and such, that kind of applies in their own way to their own innovations that they create today. You know, what was your one?
I was wondering what you're working on today. If you mentioned that you're constantly learning and it's a very important part of entrepreneurship and growing and just researching the market in general, what are you working on? What are you passionate about now?
Sure. Well, I'm actually working on a new business with two other Yalies. Actually, my brother and his classmate, they're 10 and a half years younger. So, there's an interesting generational gap there, which is actually great because they do things that I would never do and vice versa. And we have complementary networks. But I mentioned that I'm starting to focus on the private equity space. And really, it came out of my interest in basically broad-based equity. So in venture capital, we tend to just assume that everybody gets equity in a company, right? We can't pay people full freight and the salary, so we overcompensate them with equity. In private equity, that's not the case. Typically, when there's a buyout, top management gets, you know, 10, 12% of the company, and nobody else in the company has equity. And there's some groups that are trying to change that dynamic. KKR and Apollo started a nonprofit called Ownership Works. And what they're trying to do is put broad-based equity plans for their portfolio companies. There's been some very interesting success cases. Ingersoll Rand and CHI Overhead Doors, where, you know, truck drivers were getting $80,000, $200,000 from their equity positions. When the company gets sold, and that's really meaningful. And so I think that ownership in general and giving employees more of a stake in their businesses, what they called creating an ownership mindset, has the potential to really revitalize the middle class. So historically, home ownership has been, you know, has been the typical way American middle class has created value, created wealth. And that's been kind of turned on its head in the last 20 years. And I don't know if that'll change and ever go back to where it was in the 50s and 60s. But I think, giving workers some equity in their companies is a path to improving the business, right? If you've got employees that think of themselves as an owner, they're going to work harder. There's probably going to be less turnover. And there's some case studies that show it actually meaningfully improves the metrics of how a company performs. So that at the private equity level, that is a change that's happening and something that I'm really interested in. And to support that, I've started looking at the private equity fund level. And so they've got employees that work in the funds and they can put some money into the deals that they work on. But even though they might be making a couple hundred thousand dollars, they might have to put more money into these deals than they actually get paid salary on a yearly basis. And so they have liquidity problems. And a lot of employees that are being hired in the junior positions are coming from disadvantaged backgrounds. And so I'm trying to find out how to level the playing field for those employees that come from disadvantaged backgrounds so that they can participate in the investment opportunities like their wealthier cohorts, right? Their other their coworkers, and they can create that personal wealth. And so we've got a co-investment benefit that we're offering to private equity employees through the GP that allows them to commit capital to the fund. And we match their investment on a dollar for dollar basis and share our profits with them. So they can put less money to work and get a much higher return on invested capital than if they were just participating in their normal co-investment opportunity. What I think that does, that allows us to start supporting private equity professionals and then work with them to bring this down to their portfolio companies and create broad-based equity ownership programs in their portcos.
That is just an amazing idea. I'm very curious how that develops further and how it goes into the market.
Yeah,
thanks.
It's really amazing.
I was going to add, it's so interesting how, you know, making these coworkers be able to like I said, level the playing field, right? In order to, because their ability is there, right? It's more about giving them the opportunity and resources. You mentioned entrepreneurs need resources to utilize them as well, right? In order to build themselves. So kind of all flows back in the same circle.
And I think one of the things we found that most people are like, nobody's doing this. Like banks aren't going to lend to these employees. And it's really strange. Like there's the underlying assets are really valuable, right? These PE companies are consistently outperforming the markets. But banks don't want to lend to these guys. And the junior employees, they don't have assets, right? They don't own a home yet. They don't have a big asset portfolio. And so they can't get a loan. So I was really surprised. And it was my co-founder, Martine, who brought this to our attention. Born and raised in Argentina, he made it to Yale on a scholarship and he had to take out student loans. And then once he got into a really good private equity fund, he's making good money, and he wanted to put as much as he could into the deals. And so he did. And then he found that he was living like paycheck to paycheck and he was waiting for his bonus at the end of the year to catch up on the money he owed on his investments. And so that's not good for the private equity fund. It wasn't good for Martine. And so we said, okay, there's clearly an opportunity. Something's not working properly here. If nobody's willing to lend to these guys, okay, then let's figure out how we can help these employees. And then we discovered that, wow, this is a much bigger opportunity. We might not be able to. So as I said before, there's a difference between a TAM and a SAM. The TAM is hundreds of billions of dollars when you take it down across all the private equity portfolio companies. But today we can still deploy a couple billion dollars just alongside private equity employees and their co-invest. And that's a really robust SAM today. And so I think we're going to grow from a nice SAM into a much bigger SAM. Anyway, it's exciting, and I saw the opportunity from, you know, firsthand from Martine. This is a problem, and it's something that I was already passionate about. You know, trying to figure out how to revitalize the middle class, and looking at it through the lens of equity ownership. And I said, well, you know what, we can apply the same strategy and thesis to these private equity employees and use that as a jumping off point to get into this broader market.